The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Advantage Chelsea or a missed opportunity? Brilliant performances from Pulisic, Mount and Kante amongst others in the first half where Tuchel's men dominate Real Madrid. But it's still all to play for because Karim Benzema is really good at football. We'll look ahead to PSG City. We'll have the latest in the ESL fallout including Spotify for Arsenal. There's a bigger squad for Southgate. Now he can take all the right backs. Nagelsmann for Bayern. What does that mean for Spurs? And good news for anecdote fans. Ben Fisher joins us for some EFL chat, promotions, relegations, celebrating too early, joy, heartbreak, all the cliches and car parks you'll ever need. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Simon Burnton, hello.
Hi, Max.
Barney Ronne, hello.
Hi, hello everyone.
So let's begin then with Real Madrid-Chelsea. Something great about a game in the rain, isn't there? Beforehand, lots of people suggested this would be very cagey, but Chelsea started the game brilliantly. And Barney, you've praised Tuchel in the paper today for getting it right, certainly in that opening hour.
Yeah, I mean, there was a period between, I think, the 10th minute and the 30th minute where it was obvious that Chelsea had spotted a kind of weakness in Zidane's shift of defensive shape where he played three or five at the back at times. And they found the classic space down the sides of the centre-halves. There's always often a gap there if you don't get that system right. And even though Timo Werner will be criticised for missing chances, because he does miss chances, his speed and the speed of Pulisic were really key to that little plan working. So you had Rudiger playing a beautiful pass over the top, a cruise-style kind of launched pass, and this sort of strange thing where there's this just gaps there that Chelsea flooded into. And they could have scored twice, could have scored three times if they were really clinical in that little period. Madrid are too good not to kind of deal with that. So we saw them become a lot more aggressive and get close to those inside forwards. And Zidane, kind of to his credit, he's not the kind of tactical muppet people suggest. He kind of sorted it out. It wasn't the victory it looked like it was going to be at one point. But I thought Tuchel did a good thing there, and he should be praised for doing a good thing.
It's interesting you mentioned that Rudiger pass and compare it to Cruz, because when Cruz did it the other day for Vinicius, that was probably a better ball. I was like, this glorious distributor of a ball. And when Rudiger did it, I was just like, he's just lumped that upfield.
Well, they weren't the same thing. One was a longer distance and also like put with total precision onto someone's chest. Whereas that was seeing, it was like a Sunday football pass, you know, send it over the top. You know, he put it in exactly the right spot, but it was because there was a weakness there that made the pass, whereas Cruz was more kind of surgical. You made that space appear.
You mentioned Pulisic. He was superb, Barry, wasn't he? Kante was great. Mount was great. Who would you pick out if you had to? You don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, seeing as you asked so nicely, I'd probably go for Kante. You know, we all know what he's about when he's on song, and he's on song with pretty regular monotony. He's a great ball winner. He's great at driving forward. He's great at disrupting the play. And he made Madrid's midfield look very ordinary for at least, you know, the first half at least. And his energy levels are just astonishing. I don't know how he does it.
It would be very hard to play against. He'd always be there, wouldn't he? Wherever you were, he would just be there.
I would want to kick him. I would reach a point where frustration would get the better of me. I would want to kick him, but probably not be able to get it close enough to him to kick him.
Simon?
If he and Casemiro were on the same team, you would just have to give up. Like, if you were a midfielder coming across those two, there would just be no point crossing the white line.
There is an interesting sort of debate. There's a kind of culture wars debate about Kante, because there must always be a culture wars debate where some people see it as wrong to suggest that he has lots of energy and runs around everywhere, as though it's in some way denigrating his football intelligence, in that he doesn't cover every blade of grass. He covers the right blade of grass. But I mean, the fact is he does also run around. You know, he does have incredible energy. He may well be using that to run into the right places, but to praise his willingness to always cover, his diligence, you know, he doesn't walk. He's always moving. I don't know if that's to say saying that he's a sort of stupid footballer or something. I don't. It's one of those confusing things where two things can be true. He's obviously an intelligent footballer.
I certainly don't think he's stupid. I mean, he reads the game brilliantly. That is a quality I probably should have included. But
I wasn't trying to chasten you. I was just saying that someone somewhere will say that it is rude to say that he is an enthusiastic person. But it's not. I mean, that's part of his intelligence.
Nikki says, at what point do you think Timo Werner will score lots of goals? I'm convinced he will. Simon, I mean, he did miss an easy chance. I wondered if, you know, the truly great centre-forwards, you know, Van Basten or, you know, just put that, or Jimmy Greaves, just put that in the corner. And then your League Two centre-forwards just try and kick it as hard as they can. And so they also score. So because Timo Werner's just not quite as good as those really good ones, but a lot better than those other ones, he doesn't score. Is that a ridiculous theory?
So I thought with that chance, firstly, he was a bit too close to the keeper. I thought the best way for him to score was probably for him to kick it into the ground and then it bounces over him. But he was very close to the keeper that made it hard. He had to put it right in the corner and obviously he didn't. The alternative, I thought, would be for him to trap the ball. The keeper falls over anticipating a shot and then he passes it into an empty remaining part of net, which has the added bonus of humiliating the goalkeeper. But I'm very few people would have attempted that, and it's probably a stupid idea. But when is he going to score the goals? It is starting to get genuinely dispiriting now. But his movement is good, and was part of when Chelsea's dominant period. His pace and movement is always there, even if his finishing is sometimes absent.
Do you feel it's a missed opportunity, Barney? Because only the first 20 minutes, I thought Chelsea are going to win this 5-0.
Well, it's very hard to say, isn't it? Because if they can manage the second leg as well, they should probably win. It's just that old Madrid champion quality that makes you think twice, because they're such a bunch of assertive footballers, and they're so unafraid, and they will perform up to their level away from home. They won't be cowed or, you know, think, oh, no, we've got to go to Stamford Bridge. Perhaps. I mean, I was slightly... Tuchel did have seven defensive players on the pitch. And in a period when you're running through the opposition, if, for example, they hadn't had Azpilicueta at right wing-back, but had even Reece James, they could have played Callum Hudson-Odoi there. I think Marcelo had an easy afternoon. So while praising Tuchel, there were sort of some things that, obviously, that's part of his entire plan, is to provide that really secure base for his team. But I don't know, with a little bit more cavalier spirit, they could have scored more than once in that game.
I think also Marcelo, while he had quite an easy afternoon, he managed to make it look quite laboured. He was regularly AWOL, so Barney's probably right. I think it's a result you'd imagine both teams would have happily settled for before the game. Both teams would be reasonably happy with after the game, and Chelsea probably will be a little disappointed that they didn't convert more chances.
And Ramos may be back for the second leg, I think.
Yes, Sergio Ramos may be back. Eden Hazard may start. That would be quite the story if he ultimately put Chelsea out of the Champions League, his former club, but he's done very little for Real Madrid since signing because he's constantly injured. And Mende may come in for Marcelo, so could be a spruced up, stronger Real Madrid team that comes to Stamford Bridge.
Jack says, are Chelsea the good guys? Who are the good guys? Are there any good guys? Do there need to be good guys? Which I guess is a sort of European Super League based question. Barney, what do there need to be good guys?
Yeah, there must always be good guys because it's kind of theatre and pantomime. And that was the astonishing sort of feat of Tuesday, the Fulham Road Revolution, that somehow Roman Abramovich managed to, who's kind of, you know, patient zero in kind of billionaire football, managed to position himself as this kind of oligarch of the people, bringing down Florentino Perez and his member-owned club. Although, of course, Real are in many ways a kind of state-backed commodity. I mean, they're Royal Madrid. You know, they've had many advantages from that. But somehow, somehow Chelsea are the good guys here and are fighting to keep the flame of proper football alive, whereas anyone who was there in 2003 will remember them as being the team who were machine-gunning the world with money and were seen as the villains in that situation.
Now, Scott says the battle between the commentator on BT and Glenn Hoddle over how to pronounce Modric's name is fascinating. I presume Hoddle went with a hard C, and I forgive me, I don't know who was commentating, but quite fun for them to do it differently in the same game.
I was just getting too annoyed about Benzema.
That was really upsetting.
I mean, please. He pronounced it like marzipan, but Benzema. Marzipan, but Benzema. It was just too annoying. And with that and the rain, it's a wonder I actually noticed any football happening. The rain was incredible. Like, you were just waiting.
It really was.
For the puddles to form and for the game to turn into farce and chaos, which is obviously phenomenal. You know, farce and chaos is the best we can hope for from a game of football. And down it came. Down it came in sheets. And still, it just kept going away. How did that happen?
I would like to stand up slightly for Glenn Hoddle, who gets people to sort of sneer at him on Twitter a lot. And I'm always surprised by that, because I think he's a really good pundit. And I think he's a really nice guy. And he's a god of football as well. I mean, the man understands football. Obviously, he's had some odd things in the past. I would never stand up for those. And, you know, we're all on our own personal journey when it comes to understanding reincarnation. But I do think he's a genuine sort of treasure of English football, and is such a sort of nice guy. He's always very friendly away from cameras and people who know him, which is not always the case with famous ex-footballers. My outstanding memory of him is seeing him in Stalingrad at the World Cup. We were staying in the same hotel, and we both had to wait for a long time for this bus to come. It was just me and him. I don't know if you remember, that place was absolutely full of flies. It was just a world of flies. There were swarms everywhere. I remember Glenn turning to me, saying, "Well, I don't know where this bus is. It didn't seem to have turned up." And, you know, he has that kind of incredible sort of hair. It's got body and volume. And his hair was just a wall of flies. It was alive. It was like a beard of bees. But I guess some kind of product had gone into it, and flies from all the districts around had come to Glenn's hair and occupied it. And I couldn't say anything. It was one of those things where someone's sort of been shot and you're just like, "It's fine, buddy, you're going to be okay. You're okay." But Glenn and his kind of concern over the bus, his hair of flies, his nice kind of calm manner, they kind of got me through Stalingrad. It's obviously not called Stalingrad anymore. It's called Volgograd.
Yeah, I'm with you. He's a lovely man. The few times that I've met him, and he's a glorious footballer. And I enjoyed that small moment where we went from the mystery of drainage that Simon has yet to come across to Glenn Hoddle's fly hat. I was watching this game intently, but also went on a little journey to find out players that could play alongside Mason Mount. So you could have Yuki Fuji, so you could have Mount Fuji, a 39-year-old left-back who played in the J2 League. Jack Everest played 73 games for Cardiff in the mid-30s. And Etna Flanagan, who's a cornerback, played for Sligo in GAA, Baz. A few years ago.
I can't say I've heard of Etna, but
here we are.
But Sligo wouldn't be one of the stronger GA teams.
But Adam said you could have a team with Mason Mount, Ola Aina, Kristen Van Hout, Walter Otter, Jamie Mole, and Clint Hill, and then you'd have Mount Aina Hout Otter Mole Hill, which I thought was quite, doesn't quite work, but was good enough for me. Maybe I didn't. Mountain Hout Otter Molehill. Anyway, on to PSG Manchester City. Kenzo says, of the high probability events in the world, which is higher, Pep overthinking the Champions League or PSG choking? Barry?
I don't think Pep will overthink this one. And the thing is, if he overthinks it and Man City win, people won't go, oh, he overthought that. They'll just, oh, it was a good win for Man City. So his overthinking is only criticised when they lose. But talking to the press yesterday, he gave every intention. He seemed incredibly relaxed and said he just wanted his team to go out and enjoy themselves and express themselves. So we'll see. The proof will be in the pudding, I suppose. I mean, this game is... These certainly aren't the good guys, but being the massive hypocrite that I am, I can't wait to watch this game, even though I abhor everything both these clubs stand for. But I will be absolutely glued to it come 8 o'clock, as I'm sure many others will be.
Yeah, I completely disagree. I found what he said in his press conference really funny, and think he's trying so hard to not overthink it and just let's all just enjoy it. It's just fun. We're just having fun here. It's the most fake thing I think I've ever heard him say. The one thing that is not natural, Pep Guardiola, is to say, "Hey, let's all just." It's so obviously a gambit. I'm not going to overthink this. I'm going to do the exact. I sort of do it with when I'm sort of sending my sons off to play sport, and I quite want them to do well. I'll say, "You've just got to enjoy it. Just go and enjoy it." And the classic thing in coaching is you tell people to do that, but how do you enjoy it? Exactly how am I supposed to go and enjoy this? What you've told me what to do, but how do I do it? It reminds me a bit of that. There's a really good Dave Chappelle sketch or bit where he talks about people who are so fake, they make you fake. Like, "Hey, how you doing?" And you kind of go, "Yeah, how are you doing?" And you're like, "Oh, what have I said that for?" It was a bit like that. It was so fake. You can imagine all the City fans being made fake by it. "We're going to go and enjoy this. Just really enjoy it." Whereas, in fact, the correct approach is probably classic Guardiola of hugely detailed tactical preparation, which I'm sure is going on behind the scenes because they, PSG have some serious weapons that he has to find a way to deal with. So I hope for their sake they're not going to go out and just try and enjoy it because they'll probably lose 4-0.
He did, Barney, also make the point on several occasions that we are going to suffer and that, you know, PSG are very... It wasn't all happy-clappy nonsense.
Yeah. Well, that's the real him, the suffering. That's good. He should just say that stuff.
I did have one friend, Dave Morgan, who did just play really good footballer, but really did just enjoy it. So whether he scored a 25, there was one game he came on and scored an own goal with his first touch and just burst out laughing. Or just like he'd try a back heel and the opposition would go through and score and then he'd just laugh. And he genuinely just enjoyed it. And during the game, it was incredibly annoying. But afterwards, it was fine. So maybe he had it right all along. What we want City to do tonight is just laugh away. Whatever happens, if they score, they laugh. If they miss, they laugh. It doesn't matter. I mean, that is true, isn't it? Ultimately.
I'm wagering that wasn't the message he's given to his players. And that that they have something much more, I don't know, complicated and onerous to be thinking about.
I want to see them all skipping around this evening, just laughing away as Mbappe flies through again to score his third. Anyway, high-fiving him, just going, "Well done, Killian. That was a great finish."
He's obviously not saying that to players. I think he's just trying to create that vibe around them, though. He's trying to sort of lift the pressure. That's part of management. Obviously, there's two parts. But for PSG, you know, they have a really strong team. You know, obviously Neymar and Mbappe, they have Verratti back, they have Marquinhos. You know, they have the spine of their team. And so as far as the French press are concerned, this is a moment they've been sort of waiting for. They have a really strong team. They're in a semi-final again. The one thing they don't have are the fans, which is actually a big deal. You know, that ground is really noisy when they get going and it's pretty intimidating. It's always a slightly odd kind of noise. It's more like people having lots of fun and having a party rather than... It's slightly different to English football where people literally yell at the players. They sing lots of songs and have a good time. But it's really noisy and it does drive them on and they will miss that. I understand there'll be loads of fans in the streets outside the stadium making noise. But it would be a hell of an occasion if they were in, which is kind of a shame.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with a bit more of the fallout from the European Super League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Part of the fallout of the European Super League is the owner of Spotify, Daniel Ek, the founder and billionaire's plan to buy Arsenal with the help of Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira. The Cronkies say they remain 100% committed to Arsenal and are not selling any stake. We've not received any offer, will not entertain any offer. Our ambition for Arsenal remains to compete to win the biggest trophies in the game, and our focus remains on improving our competitiveness on the pitch to achieve this. What do we think about any of this? Normally, if owners come out on Twitter and say, I want to buy this, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, they would conduct their business and make their offer privately. Like, you know, when Sheikh Mansour bought Manchester City, that it was just sort of announced one day. Nobody had any inkling it was going to happen at all. And I think it's naive to think that just because one greedy billionaire has said he wants to buy the club off another greedy billionaire that the sale will happen. Cronkies are doing very well out of Arsenal. There's no reason why they should sell beyond their lack of popularity, which I think they don't really care about. And who's to say that Daniel Ek would be any better than them? And if he did buy the club, how would he finance the deal? He could be a worse owner than the Cronkies. So, you know, I don't think, as owners go, the Cronkies are particularly terrible, as billionaire Americans go. Arsenal's problem, they have good players, they're just not very good side. And so I can't see this happening, but who knows?
I suspect some Arsenal fans will rage at the thought that Cronkies are quite good.
I'm not saying they're quite good. Ideally, you wouldn't have them at the club, but the notion that a different billionaire would somehow be better, you know, is quite fanciful.
There is a chance you could, definitely a decent chance you could have a better billionaire. It's not just him, it's the, you know, Arsenal as a thing. What is it exactly now? I don't think it's being run very well at all. I mean, why is Josh Kroenke why is the owner's son in such a senior position at the club? That instantly, you know, no offence to Josh, and, you know, it's great if you can get the work, but things like that really, really do raise alarm bells for me, and I don't think it's reaching its potential. Obviously, Arsenal have suffered a lot with a lack of match day revenue. I think that's kind of hit them quite badly. There's quite a lot of things about that club that I don't think are very good, right down to the Visit Rwanda sponsorship deal, which still seems very odd to me. I do also understand the Twitter nature of this, the Spotify guy launching his bid in public. If you look at the way English football has worked in the last week, it's very hard to say that it's not hugely influenced by public clamour on digital media. I mean, that's how it works now. And everything that he's said, I mean, this guy's entire life is online. His business is online. His existence is online. That's how he communicates with the world. He's the owner of Spotify. I think there's a fair chance he probably would be better than the Cronkies. But equally, like you say, how would he finance it? What's the actual detail here? I've no idea.
Simon, you wrote a piece saying, I'm not convinced the European Super League is a bad thing. There's been a cancer growing in football, a sovereign wealth fund assisted, leveraged, buyout-based, oligarch-fronted tumour. It's just volunteered to get rid of itself. Bye.
Right, that was a tweet. Yeah, I do think that there is no way back that I can conceive for these clubs. No way back into supporter-led ownership or even minority supporter ownership. And no way back into rationality. And they're so divorced from the rest of the English football ecosystem that English football would be healthier without them. Obviously, these clubs are an embodiment of a century or more of history and of their supporters and previous generations of supporters. And there's a lot of emotional attachment to them. Fans wouldn't be willing for English football to just wave goodbye and write them off. I understand that. But I do think if you were to take them out of our league structure and they could go and play by themselves, I don't wish them any ill. I hope it would be a success, whatever enterprise they go into. Take them out of our league structure. The other, whatever, 86 would be so much healthier for them not being there. Just, you would currently be having Leicester and West Ham engaged in a thrilling title chase. West Ham, who just avoided relegation last year, could win the league this year without the six. I mean, that is, there would be competition, there would be aspiration, there would be interest and excitement at a level there isn't now. You know, the system, since the end of sharing of matchday revenue in 1983, the system has creaked in one direction. And that direction, it has been to help these big clubs, but it is also, what is it, it has achieved is to create a basically a different ecosystem living within ours, living increasingly uncomfortably within a wider ecosystem. They don't work. They're these alpha predators. They need to go and find a new sea to swim in.
It's funny. I mean, I one of the things I've felt about since the Super League brouhaha is to actually appreciate how good the Premier League and the Champions League actually are. I mean, I've spent a lot of time moaning about them professionally, but thinking about alternatives and thinking about how we've actually been able to hang on to some kind of collective strength, and that the league, you know, the league does work. We don't have one team winning all the trophies. We do have, like you say, a stratification that is simply very, very difficult to overcome. And obviously Leicester were the exception. But it did make me think that actually what exists is very good, considering the amount of nonsense that's thrown at it. You know, it's like living in the, inside an open sort of nuclear reactor, and you're somehow kind of holding on to this shape. Despite all the rubbish you throw at football, there is still a robust competition there. It made me think that actually, with a few better sort of checks and balances, and with a kind of conscious hanging on to what we've got and a reversing of some of that, we've actually got a pretty good league. I mean, I felt actually encouraged by that. It made me appreciate what is there.
Barney, you also wanted to talk about Brexit, and nobody will let you. I will let you.
Oh, I just thought it was really fascinating that I'm not a Brexit person. I feel very European. I wanted to stay in the European Union as a European. But, you know, Brexit had a really profound effect on this. And Brexit is what English clubs, the English government essentially scotched this Super League by saying, the European Commission said, we're not going to, we're going to stay out of this. This is the market. We can't touch it. Whereas Boris Johnson, empowered by his own populism and by literally by Brexit, by the fact that our parliament is sovereign, could say, I'm not going to let this happen. I will pass laws. These may well be empty threats. But it's that point where Jeremy Corbyn's opposition to the EU meets Boris Johnson's opposition. Jeremy Corbyn's theory that this is a free market enterprise and we need to sort of take back control in that sense and have regulation met Boris Johnson's idea that we should be like a kind of deregulated island doing whatever we want. And Johnson was able to borrow Corbyn's clothes and say, no, I'm going to use my sovereign parliament to pass extreme draconian regulation to stop this happening. And Britain was the only powerful country within that group able to do that, because parliament can do whatever it wants now. And I thought that was very interesting, and uncomfortable as it might sound, as I've said before, Nigel Farage stuffed the Super League. Maybe it's the first nice thing he's done for us.
It would be interesting to see Boris Johnson wearing Jeremy Corbyn's clothes as well while he undid the Super League, some ill-fitting cords, wouldn't it?
Well, his own clothes are ill-fitting enough.
Jonas says, now that three extra spots have opened up for the Euro squad, does that mean all the right-backs can make it? Additionally, each game, can Southgate just use all three subs, replacing the right-back with a new one every 20 minutes or so? And Ian makes an interesting point. Is anyone at risk of losing their spot in the England squad now that it's been expanded? Sort of utility players. Do you fear for Eric Dier? Because we don't need to pick someone who can play in midfield and in defence now. Gareth Southgate can be a bit more specific.
So what I do think, the five substitutions and an expanded squad makes a difference. And the managers can grasp the opportunity presented by five substitutions, or they can fail to do so. For example, Barnsley in the Championship, they use a lot of substitutions. They often make three changes at half time. They've still got two more substitutions if they need them. It allows the manager to give players different instructions to play it, for a player to start knowing he'll play only a half. There are interesting possibilities that five substitutions present that most managers haven't grasped. And the story of England's 1970 World Cup is in part, that was the year that substitutions were first introduced to international football. Alf Ramsey didn't understand them. He had never used a substitute in club football. And he didn't use his substitutions at all well, and particularly in the game against West Germany, England paid as a result. This summer, it might be similar in that substitutions and the use of those five subs will swing some matches. And will Southgate grasp those opportunities? And is he planning how to best take advantage of those opportunities?
I think it's quite interesting at that level of football and that level of fitness. At my rubbish level, if you come on, you are, everyone else is tired, right? And obviously, they're not running around as much and they're not as fit. But I wonder if, you know, if you do bring three fresh players on at half time, are the players that have been on the pitch fit enough that actually it makes no odds? Or does that actually make a sort of a definite difference just in terms of, because obviously, if you're not fit, if you are tired, that really affects you. I'd like the Croatians, obviously, to be tired for this one. Barry?
I think it does make a difference. I mean, the example Simon cited there, Barnsley, have used a tremendous effect. The players know how long they're going to be on for. They gad about accordingly and then come off and are replaced with like-for-like players who also know exactly how long they're going to be on for and gad about accordingly. So I do think it makes a difference. I think it's... Well, I have no problem with the change or the number of substitutions. I think it's a little unfair on... I mean, the Republic of Ireland aren't going to be there, but if they were, they just don't have the same kind of quality on the bench that other teams do, like England or France or Spain or whoever.
I don't think it's necessarily about fitness, making substitutions at that level. I think it's that the game is so tight and the patterns are so, like last night's game, for example, is so condensed. It's that changing the players you have, the runs they make, what they're doing, how they control the ball, can give you a tiny little bit of light and space before the other team can react. For example, in the way Madrid reacted last night to close that gap in the sort of Chelsea inside left. Bringing on Phil Foden for Marcus Rashford changes the whole gravity of your attack and how you're going to play. And it will take the other team and the other players a few minutes, a few movements in the game to process that and to get as close and as adapted. You stand here, you make this run. I think it's more just that getting a little bit of light into the game, a little bit of space by changing it, rather than, oh, look, Rashford's knackered, he can't run anymore. Get someone who can run, because that fat guy at the back for Belgium is exhausted. He was on the piss exactly last night. Quick, take advantage. I don't know, it's quite... I think it might be... I don't, maybe I'm wrong. It might be a little bit more, I don't know, sophisticated.
You're probably right. Charlie says, with Julian Nagelsmann going to a rival for 25 million, what would it take for Max and Barry to be prized out of Guardian Towers? Would Barry go to the Ramble on the promise of a new bathroom and kitchen? Is there something we don't know about?
No, there really isn't. Make me an offer, Ramble.
Okay. It's an interesting mid-season, you know, for the team in second. I know the title race is pretty much done, but it isn't done for them to... I know it happens in... seems to happen in Germany quite a lot. You know, managers get good. They get to a team in second and then buy and go, we'll have you now. And this is how it works. He's extraordinarily young. It's this interesting time in football where players keep going, even if they were out on the piss. You mentioned the Belgian defence. There's an example of these old players carrying on.
I mean, it's obviously part of that's to do with advancements in fitness and also with the extreme financial rewards involved in carrying on playing. That kind of helps. But if you think what players used to sort of do to their bodies... a couple of serious injuries and a lot of recreational drinking and you're pretty much done. I think there's this massive incentive to look after yourself. I also think the kind of people who make it to the top level of football now are perhaps slightly different people. A lot of footballers are kind of, well, they're very, they tend to be, you have to be able to absorb a lot of information You have to be pretty serious about this game. You need to be able to, you know, take on... It's like being an NFL player. You're given briefing documents. You have to play with your brain. And if you're able to absorb that much information about how to play and how to manage this, you know, you're likely to be able to make the calculation that if you don't drink vodka with Skittles dissolved in it every evening as a way of, you know, fixing your knee injury, you're probably going to carry on playing for four more years and make 40 million quid. So I think there's a kind of, it's just such a serious industry now, isn't it? That probably helps.
Not going to help when Pep gets everyone, just says, go and have fun. Well, after months of briefing notes. What about these briefing notes?
Well, his idea of fun, it was a really funny idea. He was saying, enjoy the coffee you have in the airport. Hey, you know, go and buy a nice pair of £300 trainers. His kind of idea of fun is all quite sort of innocent and nice. I quite enjoyed that.
You were about to mention Nagelsmann there.
Well, the reason it feels like the moment to make a change is because Bayern have gone out of the Champions League. It's an example of how that looms over their season. You know, it doesn't feel like mid-season. It feels like, OK, we'll get to the end of this thing and start again in September. And obviously they've planned this for quite a long time. He's a fascinating character, isn't he? I'm looking forward to seeing him in that crucible and under that amount of pressure. And I'm pleased that... But I always think of Bayern as a kind of dandyish club. They were formed by these kind of Jewish intellectuals and artists. They're sort of certainly decadent about them. They have these cocktail parties, and it was kind of a fun club like that. And now you've got a man turning up in kind of weird houndstooth jackets and green plus fours, and he seems like a throwback to 1920s Bayern. And hopefully he can fully exploit that.
Joe says, as a Leicester fan, I'm nervous that Brendan Rodgers keeps giving a political answer to the ESL questions that get thrown at him. Is he keeping his options open for the Spurs job? If so, why would he consider that if Leicester get into the Champions League? Discuss. Simon Burton, discuss.
Well, Rodgers, I suppose, has the experience of Celtic of being asked constantly about his future and not wanting to give anything away. And he gains nothing from making promises that don't come to pass. And so like, there was a moment when he was at Watford, which was his first managerial job, and he was being linked with Reading. And he said that just to suggest that he might even consider leaving Watford in the middle of his contract is to impugn his integrity. And 6 weeks later, he's off to Reading. So I would hope that he's learned from that, and he just balances himself on the fence. That's exactly where it's appropriate for him to be. He's doing a phenomenal job for Leicester, and that is good enough.
Steve says, given Barry's impact on Leicester's form these last few months, if Rodgers goes to Spurs, would he consider being the Foxes' boss? Yes, Ian Atcho, Barry, with another... I mean, this goal on Monday was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Yeah, he really roofed it, didn't he? Having turned his defender inside out. It's a remarkable run of form. Long may it continue. He seems like a really nice kid. And... I certainly would not. A lot of football fans think they could manage a club. I would be absolutely useless as a football manager. I couldn't manage a pub team. I would be diabolically bad. I wouldn't be able to leave people out. I wouldn't be able to explain to people why I was leaving them out. I wouldn't stand up. I would buckle in the face of fan pressure at every turn. I would be absolutely useless. So if I took the Leicester job, I suspect I won't be offered it, but if I am and I took it, I think the goals would dry up for Caliche and I would be sacked within a week.
I'm confused. I really wish you would take the Leicester job. I think you make a really good point, though. While I sit here criticising Thomas Tuchel's tactical manoeuvrings, and while we're all free to do that, and we should continue doing that, the actual job that these people do is so incredibly complex and a matter of balancing so many things. I couldn't do it. I can criticise everyone else's mistakes, but I'd be worse than you, definitely. Everyone would hate me.
I'd be so tired. I'd be like, I can't go to another one. Like, what is this? Europa League Thursday? I can't do it. Someone else go. Just let me stay at home. It's in the evening. I just don't want to be there.
Thomas Tuchel kind of said that when he was asked about the new Champions League format. You know, not in those exact words, but I think it was what he was thinking. what we were all thinking. You know, oh, it's just too much, too many games. Who's going to want to watch all these games? Nobody.
Anyway, that's a good point to finish part two. Ben Fisher will join us for part three. We'll talk about the Football League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Crunch time in the Football League. And Ben Fisher, the Guardian's EFL correspondent, joins us. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Got high hopes, as always, that you'll deliver some gold for us. Where do you want to start, Ben? Should we start at the Championship? Start with Watford?
Yeah, obviously Watford and Norwich. Watford have joined Norwich now. In returning to the Premier League at the first attempt. Bournemouth could complete the set through the playoffs. We know the four playoff teams, Brentford, Swansea, Barnsley and Bournemouth. And if Bournemouth were to do it, it would be the first time that the three that have come down from the Premier League have gone straight back up together, which seems strange, really. It feels like that should have happened before, but it hasn't. And Bournemouth look pretty good maybe to complete that set. But yeah, Watford up. And to be fair to them, always seem a bit of a basket case of a club, but they've done the business and yeah, they've made it look pretty easy in the end.
Simon, you're obviously a Watford man. Cisco Munoz has done a... I confess I didn't know a whole lot about him before this season, and I confess I don't know a whole lot about him now.
Yeah. You know, it's been a really weird season, a really strange promotion season. And one of the weird things about it is that we get to the end. We've had the most ridiculous run of form since February of something like 16 wins in 19. And at the end of it, I'm not convinced about the manager. And Watford fans are used to managers coming and going with great regularity. So he's obviously a really nice guy. He took over a squad that was in a kind of souring psychologically. The previous manager was very... In both demeanour and tactics, he was very dour. And a squad that was that believed at the start of the season that they would romp away with the league was being left behind. And they were starting to turn on themselves. And Munoz arrived and he has turned that around. He is a very happy, seems to be a naturally happy individual who is a pleasure to be around. And he has that. And you also mustn't underestimate how little he knew when he was appointed. He was a magnificently obscure appointment.
Did he know he was being appointed when you say how little he knew?
Well,
he was just passing.
I think he had recently finished working in Georgia. I don't think he knew the Championship at all. I don't think he knew Watford's squad at all. And he was still, like in his programme notes for Saturday's game against Millwall, he made the point that his opposite number has the advantage of understanding the division and knowing the division that he has never had. It was a strange appointment that has worked in terms of squad kind of morale. But I'm not sure how tactically astute he is. He doesn't seem to use his substitutions to change games particularly. So my mind is open, but I've seen him be profoundly outcoached by Mark Warburton. And that does make me worry a bit about what Premier League coaches will do to his Watford team.
Will he definitely be in charge of Watford next season for at the start of the season, do you think?
I think that I would say probably 90% at this point. I'm 90% sure that he will start the season.
It sounds like a sitcom.
Why do Watford do this? Why do they... What is it? It's like people... They remind me of like a kind of, you know, hipster coffee shack where you get this ever more obscure... kind of a roast or bean or treatment. I mean, why? What is it? Is it some sort of elaborate satire on the idea of football managers? We're going to pluck another sort of puzzled-looking man you've never heard of from an ever more obscure place. Why are they doing it?
I've got absolutely no idea what led them to Munoz's door when they needed a new manager at the end of last year. He shares an agent with a couple of current or recent Watford players, which I may have had something to do with it. It was vitally important that Watford got promoted this season because parachute payments only really allow you to go full tilt once. And they had wasted an appointment on Vladimir Ivic that hadn't worked out. We were being dropped by the leading clubs. And they couldn't make a mistake without having very severe potential repercussions for the future of the club. And at that point, when the margin for error was non-existent, they thought, yeah, that bloke who's managed 11 games in Georgia, he's the one.
What was Kike Sanchez Flores in your coffee bean analogy? Is he the house blend that people say, we brought it back because everybody likes this. So every other week you get the house blend back and then they get an even more obscure coffee bean. I love the idea that he didn't know anything. It's a sitcom, isn't it? A happy man wandering around Georgia comes in, says, I don't know what this is, but I'll be jolly, like a jolly man. Ben, can we talk about Barnsley? We've mentioned them briefly in the pod already, but they are the club you look at in the playoffs and think, what are they doing there?
Yeah, they are undoubtedly the story of the season, I think, regardless really of what happens now. But obviously from their eyes, they want to go one or two steps better. Amazingly, this time last season, so with two games to go, they were bottom of the league. I mean, it is just bonkers. Yeah, kudos to their recruitment and kind of holding their nerve steady. Steady thinking, consistent thinking, and they've plucked another one. Daryl DK, the American striker who joined in February, scored 9 goals since arriving on loan from Orlando City. He's only 20. He's done it all, sort of bicycle kicks, screamers, you name it. And only, I think, 18 months ago, he was studying finance at Virginia, playing college football. I mean, it's an amazing story. Valerian Ishmael, the head coach, who arrived with a good reputation, but you know, nobody expected this. And now they are the team that nobody wants to play in the playoffs. You speak to the other teams and people at those clubs, and they are very wary of Barnsley, especially in a one-off game, because they make life very difficult for you. And they're quite unorthodox. They're quite happy to be... I don't know. I mean, some managers have said they're quite...
aren't they like John Beck? Are they play absolute dirty shit house long ball, or is that too harsh?
I think that might be pushing it. I mean, they definitely are sort of upping at you, but I think they're happy with that tag, you know. And they're at the stage now where they're just so close. I mean, it'd be interesting if they rest players in the next couple of games, because Ishmael's thinking and philosophy, if you like, is all about freshness and how can we get players at full tilt for 60 or 90 minutes, whatever it might be. I think I've spoken before about how he likes to make triple changes at half time, or certainly by the hour mark. That's not unusual. So, yeah, they're definitely the team that Brentford, Swansea and Bournemouth are probably most fearful of, I think it's fair to say.
Oh, sorry, Barney, did you want to ask a question?
I was just going to say, I saw Barnsley at the Den last season. It was, I think, probably the game where their season started to turn. And what was really striking was they came back to win the game. They won it in the last minute. But the fans, we just spent the whole game looking at their fans in the away end. They didn't stop. Like, they have a really hardcore away support. It was freezing. It was just before Christmas. And it was the large pink blokes with shirts off thing. There was this huge group of them bouncing around in the away end, taunting the Millwall fans. Didn't stop yelling, actually. And they were, you kind of thought, there's some weird energy here that hasn't quite been expressed. And the team, I've always associated them with that small knot of shirtless, freezing, mad pink blokes bouncing up and down. Like, they do have a kind of wild energy. And they would be good fun in the Premier League, those people, if they can get there.
Do they rotate after 60 minutes as well, just to sort of keep fresh, the shirtless mob?
They seem to keep going the whole time. They seem to be powered by some mysterious energy, some kind of intake that powered them on.
We should give Jonathan Woodgate some praise, because I think when he took that job, or when he was given it sort of on a sort of temporary basis, people thought this wasn't necessarily the best idea. Middlesbrough hadn't gone brilliantly for him, but he's done very well to steady that ship.
Yes, it seemed a bit of a thankless task, to be honest. Obviously, he came in under Jason Tindall, who's now an assistant at Sheffield United, ends up, you know, suddenly in charge quite a long way from home. And he's done a really good job. I think you have to give him credit. I personally didn't think they would make the playoffs. I thought that chance had possibly gone, but they put a really good run of results together. I think it was 7 wins or so in a row. Lost to Brentford the other day, but yeah, they probably have the best squad. I think it's fair to say in that playoff bunch. But as we know, it doesn't work like that. But yeah, Woodgate's done a great job, to be fair. And I think his kind of straight talking, back to basics, if you like, is definitely rubbed off on players. It were just kind of, I don't know, maybe weren't quite performing as they should under the previous manager.
Barry putting his fingers in his mouth. It's quite sensual.
Sorry. it wasn't my intention to turn you on.
At the bottom, I mean, Wayne Rooney is not safe yet, are they? Derby, you think, will survive, but it's two of three, right? It's Wickham are down, and then it's Sheffield Wednesday, who obviously had that points deduction, and Rotherham. But Rotherham, they've got a game in hand on Derby. I know they lost last night.
Yeah, Rotherham, Paul Warne, I think, is fearing that his players have maybe just run out of steam. As you say, they've got a game in hand, but maybe their inability to close that gap in the games remaining might just let Derby off the hook. It's interesting because Derby play Sheffield Wednesday on the final day, and it would be great, I suppose, from the neutral's point of view, if there was something riding on that. But it kind of all rests now on Rotherham. So if they can pull a win out in the next week or so, that would certainly up the ante.
What's the feeling about Rooney at Derby?
I think the feeling is he's done quite a good job. And in fairness, there's been so much off-field stuff going on just from start to finish. It's been a bit chaotic, I think it's fair to say. Another sort of takeover now that is already rumbling on, I suppose. Obviously, results haven't been brilliant. And they've lacked goals all season, which I think I said before is weird for a team managed by a top goal scorer in his day.
In League One, I really enjoyed Peterborough last night. Nathan Albon's thread. On our way, Peterborough 2 up inside 23 minutes. Some fans are already celebrating. Posher promoted with a win. Fireworks going off outside the ground. Here's the scene at the Peacock Pub on London Road. Similar scenes at Charters Pub on London Road. The flares are lit. The bubbly's on ice. 45 minutes from the Championship. Posh going to the second half. 2-1 up. Lincoln have won. Posh need a win to clinch promotion tonight. As night falls, Posh fans are lighting up the London Road car park. Next one. The wait goes on. Peterborough 2, Doncaster 2. Peterborough just need a draw at home to Lincoln on Saturday to clinch promotion. Lincoln obviously plays below them. They'll probably do it, won't they? But it was quite fun to see them all celebrating and celebrating a bit too early.
Yeah, I still think Peterborough will get over the line. And obviously for them, they've been sort of marooned in League One for a very long time now. And every year they seem to be the favourites to go up. They always have a goal scorer, as we know. Obviously Ivan Toney last season, this season Johnson Clark-Harris. Would be surprised if they didn't go over the line. But I think it would be quite a big thing for them because last season, the way it ended when they missed out on the playoffs on PPG, Barry Fry, the great Barry Fry said, called, I think, Darren McAntony got together and called this the Vengeance Tour. So they're close to finishing that. Yeah, let's hope they do it.
Fun evening for John Marquis at Portsmouth, wasn't it?
Yeah, scored at both ends. Thought he'd snatched a sort of stoppage time winner and then goes in off, I think he was off his backside in the end, in the 95th minute, I believe. And Pompey won it.
Sometimes that's you just need one to go
at the other end,
off your backside, don't you?
Pompey, one of those teams, one of the clutch of teams trying to get in the playoffs. Danny Cowley had that kind of initial bounce. And now I still think they might get in there. I think them and Charlton look pretty well placed.
There are mumblings of discontent at Sunderland, Ben, calls for Lee Johnson to go after he got off to a fairly blistering start, and I think they're without a win in seven now. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think it's a funny one because when he was at Bristol City, three and a half years, I believe, and he kind of ended up with this nickname, Streaky Johnson, which I think, in fairness, probably came to him through the local press. But he referenced it himself once in a post-match. And that is the case. I mean, they went 14 games unbeaten. But I think it's now seven without a win.
Well, it looked like they were going to win the division at one stage, and then it all went peak-tong.
Yeah, I know they've had injuries to defenders, and I know they felt that's been quite a big factor. But I still think they've got, a lot more resource than some of the teams that they're coming up against. But it seems to be one of those things. I don't know if you can relate the two. It seems too coincidental, but he definitely does go on streaks as manager. It's just, why does that happen? I mean, if he knew, he'd clearly rectify it. But they still, I think, will get in the playoffs and therefore have a great opportunity to go up. But it's been a bit rocky, hasn't it?
You say a great opportunity. It's Sunderland.
I think the chances of them winning two Wembley finals in one season are slim, to say the least.
Paul says, hi, Max. Could you give Cheltenham Town a mention in the next pod? Best team in League Two. First team to take the lead against Manchester City in 20 matches. First to go up from League Two. Has Barry ever been to Cheltenham? I don't know why we need that last question, but he wants to know the answer.
I've been to Cheltenham for the races on several occasions, but never for a football match.
Well done to Michael Duff, who's a lovely man, and he has a lucky gilet that he puts on or takes off, depending on whether they're winning or not. First time since 2009 they've been in the third tier after waiting 100 years. Cambridge need a point at Harrogate on Friday, and Harrogate have the FA Trophy on Monday, so I'm desperate that they rest all their players. I'm just terrified about the whole thing. Forest Green, the interesting one there, Ben, who just absolutely disappeared. It was like they were basically one of the three who were going for automatic. And now it looks like Cambridge and Bolton, with Cheltenham, unless Morecambe can do something pretty special.
Yeah, and Forest Green might end up missing out on the playoffs at this rate. They seem to have this habit of capitulating just when it matters. Obviously, got rid of Mark Cooper. Be interesting where they turn next. Del Vince is obviously quite innovative and is open to all ideas. I know they've had about more than 100 CVs in, so you know, no shortage of interest in that job. But yeah, they've missed out, and obviously rivals Cheltenham have done really well. And like you say, Michael Duff, I think that might go not under the radar, but he's done a hell of a job there. When he took over, they were going nowhere fast. Bottom six budget, obviously got to playoffs last season, to bounce back the way they have. Brilliant, and they play some really good stuff as well.
Ben, have you had any parking mishaps recently?
I haven't, but I mean, the playoff season is almost upon us, which means Wembley. Yeah. So maybe, yeah. I don't want to tease, but maybe some new material in the pipeline. Who knows?
That's big. Peter says, is, rather than it being measured by the ownership of John Lewis furniture, the real measure of being upper middle class is not understanding what a meat raffle is, like Max so obviously displayed on the last pod. I'd just like to contend with that.
Well, but before you contend with it, I found it extraordinary that someone who is married to an Australian didn't know what a meat raffle was. I didn't mention it at the time, but now that someone else has brought it up, it's staggering.
I know what a meat raffle is. I've won meat at a meat raffle. The thing about the meat raffle that Wilson did was there was only one top prize of a big box of meat. At the meat raffle I was at, maybe it was just a different version of a meat raffle, I just won one pork chop. So like there was like a, you know, it's sort of, I think at the meat raffle I was at, if you won, you could like take something from the box of meat. So just spread out the prizes.
There was basically just a cow standing there, and if your number was drawn out, you were handed a knife, a machete.
Yeah, exactly. So I do know what a meat raffle is, and therefore I am still a man of the people. Jeremy says, I couldn't hear the answer to the Costa Rica hat trick because Barry and Wilson shouting. And Max, could you re-say the Japanese name that you think Wilson said? I died laughing when he went in a Mordor.
Palo One Chop was the Costa Rican, which is what you won at the meat raffle. One Chop.
Exactly right. It all comes full circle. Well, listen, thanks so much, everybody, for coming on. Thank you, Simon.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Barney.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Just said before the pod, just have fun, everybody. Don't feel the pressure. And that's what we did.
Can I state for the record, by the way, because I think Barney has twisted my words to make it sound like I said Stan Kroenke was a good owner of Arsenal. That is not what I said, before people start getting cross with me on the internet.
Too late now.
No, it's too late. You can't regret what you've said. You said it because you meant it, and these things can't be taken back.
You love the Kroenkes. You prefer the Kroenkes to the Crankies, Barry. That's what you are. We'll be back on tomorrow. Yes, we'll be back tomorrow. For more great podcasts from The Guardian,